CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world. Financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers. Lee, if you'd like to introduce our sponsors.
Absolutely. Today's show is sponsored by Delaney Consulting LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management, and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney as outstanding and excellent. Also, SAP Business by Design, a fully integrated business management software solution designed for small to mid-sized companies that want the benefits of large-scale business applications without the need for large IT infrastructure.
And starting off with this week's CFO news, this month the Securities and Exchange Commission stated the commission is proposing new rules and forms to implement Section 21F of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, entitled Securities, Whistleblower Incentives and Protection, and seeking comment thereon. The Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, enacted on July 21, 2010, established a whistleblower program that requires the Commission to pay an award under regulations prescribed by the Commission and subject to certain limitations to eligible whistleblowers who voluntarily provide the Commission with original information about a violation of the federal securities laws, which would lead to the successful enforcement of a covered judicial or administrative action or a related action. Dodd-Frank also prohibits retaliation by employers against individuals that provide the commission with such information about potential securities violations. If you would like to submit a comment, comments should be submitted on or before December the 17th, 2010. And today I would like to welcome Louise Fisher. She joins us from the UK to discuss the role of human resources and its impact on the CFO. Welcome to the show, Louise.
Hi there.
Well, Louise, you are the Group Resources Director of Xerox in Europe. Previously, you held operations and HR roles in a variety of international blue-chip organizations, including Woolworths and Grand Metropolitan. Following this, you specialized in training management and organizational development in retail and hotel industries in Topshop and Topman and also Forte Hotels. Later, you took the position of an HR director in various printing and publishing companies and IT organizations, including the Hearst Publishing Group and ICL Fujitsu Services. You hold a Master of Arts degree in Human Resource Management, and you're a fellow of the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development, CIPD. You've contributed to a CIPD publication on international merger and acquisitions, and you're a non-executive director sitting on the executive board of the CIPD and also its audit committee.
That's right.
So Louise, tell us, that's a lot of stuff. Tell us a little bit about your background, and maybe let's start by your first job. What was it and what lessons did you learn from your time there?
Well, my very first job was as a paper girl. So I used to get up at the crack of dawn and deliver papers to people's houses and for not much money in those days. Then I trained as a gymnastics coach. So I earned quite a bit of money as I was a gymnast. When I became too old at the age of 14 to become a gymnast any longer, I then trained as a coach and coached other junior gymnasts. But I guess you could say my first proper job was when I joined Woolworths as a Saturday assistant and did that for 2 years, loved it, got promoted to being a supervisor on a Saturday, again, loved that. And so when I was 18, I left the education system after having done A-levels and joined the Woolworths Graduate Training Program, where I did a degree at the same time as working for the company.
Now, that's a tough way to do it. You started your career, went straight into the workforce. You chose to study both your degree at the same time of working. Why did you choose this? Was it the lure of working? Was it the money? Was it just that that was a good fit for you? What was it?
I just loved the company, loved what I was doing, and had some early success, an early promotion as a young 16-year-old, and just loved, you know, the way of making profit. It just seemed natural to me. So loved it, and I had the best of both worlds. The company funded me to do my degree, and I was working and, you know, getting new skills. So absolutely loved the workplace.
So let's go back to some of those gymnastics days and paper girl days. What did you learn from that? Was it a case of getting up, getting out of bed?
Well, I have to say, I always have been an early riser, so the paper girl thing was never a problem for me. But as the papers got heavier and heavier and heavier, my sister and I decided we would share the rounds, and then you're splitting the money both ways. So
at that point, you were an entrepreneur. You were paying her.
Well, I would say more and more we were sharing the workload rather than me being the entrepreneur, to be honest.
And then in a time where you didn't have to pay the tax man, huh?
Well, when you're 16 in the UK, you start paying what we call national insurance contributions. So at the age of 16, I was already in the system paying my contributions.
Very neat, very neat. So you're now with Woolworths. What was your first role?
Well, I joined the graduate scheme, so I worked everywhere in the store. So I was I was selling furniture, I was selling record players, I was selling music discs, I was selling light shades, lamp bulbs. I worked on the delicatessen counter, so I was selling food. It taught me new skills. I had never filleted a fish before, so I learned how to fillet a fish because in those days Woolworths sold food in the UK. So I did everything.
And how long were you with Woolworths?
11 years in total.
So explain to us some of your ongoing roles. What did you do?
So after I'd been in the graduate training program for 2 years, I was appointed as what we called in those days a deputy to the personnel manager, the old-fashioned name for what now is known as HR. I became the deputy personnel manager in one of the superstores, and then I was promoted to the personnel manager when the personnel manager moved on. Did that role for 4 years. Then Woolworths was bought out from its American parent during that time and became an independent UK company. And there was a lot of reorganisation going on. So I moved into an area role where I closed down a number of the superstores and made 2,500 people redundant in that time. And bearing in mind, I'm still in my mid-20s this time.
And you were actually laying people off, making them redundant?
Yes, we were. We were closing stores and moving to different locations and moving to a different business strategy of having smaller local stores rather than these big stores that were selling food. Because as the supermarkets were becoming more established in the UK, Woolworths absolutely had no unique offer in that area. So we had to close down the superstores. So, yes, negotiating with trade unions, building relationships with trade unions, closing down stores, as well as the stores that were being retained, trying to keep those people motivated and help them see there was a future for them still in this new world.
And you're still, what, 24, 25?
That's right, yes.
So how was that? What was laying
off? I have to say it was a real eye-opener. Every single person was different. Some people were, you know, older in years and walked out the door with a substantial redundancy payment and, you know, were very happy. Others had worked for the company for years and years and saw this as their family being closed and were in tears. And so every person, their circumstances were unique. Their reaction to the news was unique.
Wow. So that's been quite a substantial position, very, very young.
Yeah.
And you were closing down business units. Was there any positive growth coming from the organization? Were you opening up stores at the same time?
Yes, we were. So we were moving to much more, a more local strategy. And so we were creating work, but in different locations. So, and very different stores needing very different skills. So at the time, in my early career with Woolworths, the store manager was the king. What they could decide what to sell, they could decide how much to sell it for, what offers, what promotions, and the store manager grew very rich in those days. But what Woolworths was trying to do when it moved away from the American parent was make sure there was consistency everywhere, so you knew what you were getting, whichever Woolworths store you went into. So the store manager's role became much more around merchandising and local selling rather than strategically deciding what to sell. So very different role.
So help me understand your reference there to merchandising. Is that more of a selection from a pre-canned list?
No, you would be sent, you know, a picture. This is how you display. This is where you display. And because the people who manufacture the products obviously would pay Woolworths for the rights to put those things in their store in those days. So, yeah, so Mars or Procter & Gamble or whoever was the company whose goods it were, you would work with them and centrally that would all be decided. So a store manager's role became very different.
So in those operations roles that you had described where you were, you know, doing the fish and selling light bulbs and those kind of things, did you work in a merchandising capacity or a purchasing capacity at one point?
No, as I say, that was I was a recipient of what had already been decided to be sold, so I was a local salesperson.
And at this point, you're 100% human resources or personnel, as we called it then.
So I was the regional personnel manager for a number of stores in different countries. Probably to Americans, it's the one country, but Scotland, Ireland and England.
And were there different laws in those countries at that time?
No. I mean, in Ireland, obviously, because it was the time of the Troubles over in Ireland, there was very different discrimination law, anti-religious discrimination law. But apart from that, it was the same law.
So that, again, in your 20s, you were dealing with, were there unions over in those other countries as well as England?
Yes. So dealing with the local shop steward, as we called it, negotiating the terms of the closure. And I have to say, Woolworths in that at that time was pretty generous with its severance terms. So there wasn't really much for the trade unions to get angry about or to challenge us with.
Interesting. So what happened after Woolworths?
Well, after I was the regional personnel manager and we'd shut all the superstores, I decided to move into a training role. Excuse me. And so I moved to the corporate office and did that role for about 18 months, developing training materials, and fell in love with training and development. So after a period of time, I decided that I'd like to move on. There was nothing else in the Woolworths group that interested me. So I looked outside and I then moved to a company called GrandMet. Again, that company has morphed into Diageo, which is better known as a drinks company now. But at that time, it had restaurants and was a very diverse group. And so I moved into the branded restaurants division there in a training and development role.
So you've been in retail. Now you're in a different form of a retail. It's food and service from a perspective of a daily customer. Did that change your personnel role?
I specialised in training and development, so I wasn't getting involved in any of the personnel aspects of the role. But we were running graduate and A-level training programmes, and I hadn't been engaged in that before. But I think the difference for me in my role was the business aspect. This was a marketing business, and Woolworths marketing really wasn't that big a deal. So I moved into an organisation where, marketing was the key aspect of the group. So if you weren't marketing your products or marketing the brands, and the brands had a value on the balance sheet, again, something I had never been used to before. So for me, learning about a different business rather than the aspects of the training role I was doing.
Love that you've already mentioned the balance sheet, being that we're a CFO radio show. Enjoy that. So let's talk a little bit about that. As a human resources and personnel manager, and now you're in training and management, to what extent at that point did you manage a P&L or some kind of a budget?
So I certainly in Woolworths, I would have been responsible for the departments that I was running, absolutely for the profitability and the revenue of those departments. When I moved into being the personnel manager of the store, I was always also the deputy manager of the store. So again, had ownership at a very early age for deputising when the general manager wasn't there. And again, working with him on the planning and the budgeting aspects. I have to say, I think even in my career now that has stayed with me, that I'm a very commercial HR person because of my early retail days. But in the role with GrandMet, yes, I had a training budget and I was managing the budget, but I was only there a short period of time, so I can't really say that there was really much linked to the financial aspects of the group.
And was GrandMet going through any kind of merger and acquisition transactions at that time?
Yes, yeah, so the company had sold a company called Compass Catering, which is now a very big catering company that used to be part of the GrandMet group. And also the reason I left the company was that the business I was in was also sold. So they decided to focus on the drinks division, and the business I was in was sold to a company called Mecca Leisure. And so I was made redundant at that time when we closed the business.
So having made 2,500 people redundant, you laid off a team and then what, you laid yourself off as the last person?
Well, no, I was in training, so someone did it to me.
Oh, so how did that feel?
Yeah, I have to say, I knew it was coming because we knew the business was up for sale. But even so, it was still a shock on the day when I was sat down and formally told about it. And, you know, you can fully appreciate the people who don't know that it's coming, how shocking a situation it is for them.
And at what age are you now?
Oh, gosh, I can't remember.
28, 30?
I'm guessing, yes.
So you've laid off a couple of thousand people yourself, and maybe 4 or 5 years on, you're now being laid off for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all probably realistically before 30 years old.
Yes, probably. And I have to say, I mean, because we knew the business was being sold, I was able to start looking for a role. So even after I was told I was being made redundant, I was still kept on and a retainer because they still needed all of the training and development activities that I was managing being done. Because as the business was opening new restaurants, you needed to go in and make sure the staff were trained. So I was in, you know, probably a very fortunate position in that I was able to seek a new role, which I did, at the same time as that knowing I was being made redundant. So, you know, not as difficult a situation for me as it is for some others.
So did you keep with the hotel restaurant theme?
No, I moved to a very different business, Topshop, Top Man, and I think that's probably a well-known brand over in the US. But Topshop, for those who don't know, is the fashion shop for the young girls. And so, again, high street retailing. So back to high street retailing again. But again, the fascination for me there was that the buyers and merchandisers were kings and the store managers were much more like the store manager had been at the Woolworths Group latterly.
So did you have a P&L responsibility back at the store level or are you now corporate?
Yeah, no. So I was in the central corporate function running the retail training business, training team, sorry. And so, again, I had a budget to manage. I had graduate and A-level training programs that we were running to bring in new trainees. So, again, making sure that all of those people learned about running a business, learned about P&L management, learned about managing teams, managing people. So, I was managing the team who were doing all this work out in the retail stores.
So, as we look at this, we've talked a lot about various different change and HR, human resources, and today human capital. And I guess there's another couple of in vogue comments in terms of names that we call the personnel function. It's changed over the years. When you look back, is the function of either the management or the hiring, the training, or any of the other elements, has it changed considerably?
No, I have to say, I mean, I think tools and techniques you may use to do the hiring may be different. But at the end of the day, hiring is about getting great people to work with you in your organization, and cultural fit is so important. So I think maybe there's a recognition that it's not just hiring for somebody's skill set. Cultural fit is much more important now, I think, and recognized now.
And obviously our program is about the CFO and interviewing the finance function. Talk to us a little bit about the typical interaction today of the human resource function and the CFO, or what would be called perhaps in Europe the FD, financial director.
Yeah. Well, for me, it's always been one of the key relationships that I've had when I've been an HR director is that, you know, clearly one of the most important relationships is with your CEO or your managing director. And that absolutely has to be something that, you hold the same values, you work together on business decisions and, you know, whether they be difficult business decisions or you know, decisions that are good for the employees, should I say. But for me, the next one is the CFO, and I've always worked very closely with my CFO. And I see that as an absolute key relationship, that our agendas should absolutely be in tandem.
So let's start back into you looking at the position of maybe being in that new company, in that new role. Would you perhaps starting out ask to meet with the CFO before joining? Is it that close a relationship?
I'm just trying to think back to, no, I probably... I'm just trying to think back when I joined a new company. Certainly at Forte, it was a key relationship when I joined there. The other roles, I've been internally promoted, so I would have known the people I was working with. But yes, I mean, absolutely key. And if I can't get on with the CFO and if he can't get on with me or she can't get on with me, then, you know, I think it's not a good marriage.
Yeah, yeah. So the human resources role, it's about finding talent, training talent, retaining people, giving them promotional opportunities and giving them personal growth. But it all comes back to running a business. You said that you're a more commercial side. So what kinds of interactions and what strategic discussions do you have with that CFO?
Well, in my current role, because I'm an HR director, it's probably starting much earlier in the process than a classical HR manager or a finance manager might do with each other. You know, the horizons are longer. So you're planning for, in my case, 1 to 3 years out. And I would be working as part of the team developing the business strategy. And the CFO role would be on, you know, gathering the business data, the financial data, etc. And my role would be around, well, actually, we need to invest or disinvest in certain areas. So the HR role is around, for me, thinking about 3 years ahead, what are the capabilities, what are the skills that we need to have in place, where should the workforce be, which geographies, etc., for the business to deliver its business strategy. And these things you can't change in a month. You know, you have to work hard and develop plans for those. And of course, what you need is support from the finance function to have the investment so that they can do the right things to enable those investments to be ready when you need them.
And we've talked a little bit about your changing roles early on in your career. You went on and you have managed human resources functions not only in Europe but other parts of the world. And today, I guess, a homegrown company, one person in their basement can become quite successful selling across the world because the internet has really opened up the world to everyone. Tell us about the aspects of globalization that you have managed. You're talking about opening up new locations, hiring, working on the planning and the budgeting, and very strategic aspects.
Mm. Yeah, so I think when you're talking globally, and or in my case, I have a European role, you have to look at things like career progression across those geographies, opportunities for people, and certainly employees who want a global role absolutely are attracted to companies with a European or a global presence because that gives them that opportunity. So I think the world, you know, nowadays the world has no boundaries. You know, you could do a global role from any location, and most companies who are global will have a follow the sun outlook so that they'll have work that can be done anytime, anywhere, in any location and handed off. You know, following the sun. So I think, you know, I find it fascinating. I like learning about different cultures. I like working with people who have different cultural experiences and backgrounds that I can learn from. And I think more and more people are getting that way.
What other countries or areas of the world have you overseen?
So I've had European accountability in my current role, my previous role. And when I worked at Forte, I had global accountability for the sales force. So that was across all the geographies of the world, including North America. And I've also looked after Middle East and Eastern Europe as well as Western Europe.
Are there any different aspects of Middle East, Western Europe, Eastern Europe, and America, for example, unions, any different bargaining agreements, those kinds of things that affect the human resource?
Yeah, I mean, the legislation, even in Europe, the legislation is different from country to country. Although we're one part of one Europe, there's a base level of legislation that every country has to meet. But classically, that bar was put, at the low point. So there are many countries with practices that are higher than the bar that the European Union has put in place. But yes, I mean, the Middle East is very different. North America is very different. But I think wherever you work, business managers, and I include, all functional managers, finance, HR, marketing, and business managers, we all have a responsibility to make sure that we've got the brightest people, that we develop those people, that they have a future, and that we treat them with dignity and respect. And, that's true in any geography, in my view.
Is there any aspect when you look at the finance function, and I'm going to put you on the spot here, being that I'm a finance head myself, we tend to be looked at as perhaps not the outgoing social type of people. We tend to be looked at perhaps not as the warm and fuzzy kind of a people. Do you see anything that perhaps is an attribute that the finance function could maybe learn from in terms of developing people and the people side of the finance function?
I understand your generalization there, and I think you know, you could, there are perceptions of each function. And I think I've worked with some very outrageous finance people, and I've worked with some very introverted finance people, and both work depending on the organization. So, but I think you could say the same about the HR function. There are some very commercial, very bright, very extroverted HR people, and there are the opposite as well. So, whilst I understand your generalization. So what could the finance function learn about people management? Well, I think, I think, and I've noticed this since I've worked for an American corporation for the first time, that the culture seems to be much more quarterly focused. And good finance people, the same as good HR people, I think, need to, you know, look 3 years hence. So, okay, we're making decisions now for the quarter. We need to deliver the quarterly results. That's absolutely understood. But there needs to be a strategic element to the finance role as well. And managing people and managing the finance functions. So, again, there are the people ready in 3 years' time with the skill set, with the business knowledge for whatever that business is going to be in 3 years' time.
That is very interesting. And obviously the role of any leader is to have good talent, have it on board when you need it, for that succession planning. The role of the finance function is often in terms of the broad spectrum of a company and its operations. It's often a very technical expertise that you're hiring for, and sometimes CFOs find it hard to find good talent. And we've had many guests on the radio show that have said that their number one challenge going into the next year and then the year on after is to find the right talent. Would you say that some of the key challenges facing the CFO in recruiting is about finding the talent, but perhaps also speak more broadly to what is the role? Is that a challenge for any role of a leader today?
Yeah, and I mean, to answer the question about the finance function, again, I think that the classic mistake is hiring for today. You've got a problem today, a job you need to fill today, so you fill that gap without thinking, actually, what do I need that person to be doing in 3 years' time, and have they got the capability to move to that new role in 3 years' time, or have they got the skills to be developed? You know, are they trainable? Do they have great learning agility, etc.? So I think that's a classic mistake that anybody could make. But I think maybe finance people, because, again, it's back to this, you know, we need to close the books every quarter. Maybe that's a mistake that they could fall into.
Yes. And one of the things that I would like to talk about in terms of that quarter, that structure, that forward looking, as your roles have led you into major restructuring and organizational change programs, you're talking now about that 1 year, that 3 year look, acquisitions, disposals. You've already also, held leading roles in very large scale outsourcing companies. Tell us a little bit about that key change management component. Where do companies need to focus if they're considering those large changes?
So I think making sure you've got the resources to manage the change program is one of the classic mistakes I see, that people think they can manage a change program of such a substantial size as well as doing their day job, and that's a classic mistake. I think change projects work best where you've got a change team. However, I think even with having a change team, there can be mistakes in that they become isolated and they manage that change program, complete isolation from what's going on in the business. So, again, I would say have a change team in place, but keep it fully integrated with the business so that they can be flexible, adaptable if there are changing business requirements, rather than following the original change plan that might have been developed for that group. But in terms of outsourcing, outsourcing is the way of the world now, and you know, more and more companies are absolutely recognizing that they need to focus on their core and, you know, outsource maybe the back office functions or other functions, so that they've got the time and the skill set to focus on their core. So it's happening more and more all across the globe now.
One of our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, actually forms part of an outsourcing relationship in terms of temporary and permanent recruiting for the accounting and finance function. Are you finding that companies, do you learn or hear about companies that are outsourcing, I guess, billing might go to various parts of Asia or India, now Latin America, and even the Philippines is being talked about. And now there are terms about outsourcing and insourcing and offshoring. shoring and onshoring, and sometimes it's a little bit like the discussion of redundancy became downsizing and outsizing and leftsizing. And I mean, what do all these terms mean, and what is the real reality of what's happening for the business?
So I think any outsourcing, you need to be working with the client. So what is the client trying to achieve? What are their business objectives for doing it? And many clients in outsourcing situations absolutely want to outsource the activity to be managed by a third party, but may decide that they want to keep it on site and are prepared to pay for that. Other organisations say, no, absolutely, one of our objectives is we want it done for the lowest cost with the best quality, and we have no idea where you can do that. You tell us. So they have no allegiance to whether it's done on their client site or the activities done across the globe somewhere else. So I think it's back to what's the client trying to achieve and what's the right solution. And you're absolutely right. There are a plethora of terms in the outsourcing world: nearshoring, bestshoring, offshoring, etc. You know, there are classic terms. Lift and shift is another one. You know,
what's lift and shift?
So that's you know, when you lift a company's activities and you just shift it to a low cost geography or another geography. So lift, and you don't transform it. You do it in exactly the same way, but for lower cost. So that's lift and shift.
So the CFO is going to love that, right? I mean, is the CFO's coming to you? And well, I suppose I don't want to ask you to talk about your current company, but in general, is that a lower cost scenario because you can project somebody managing that on a month-to-month basis, or is it that you're getting lesser skilled people? What creates that lower cost?
Usually labor arbitrage. Or technology, that the company you're outsourcing to has better technology, they've invested in technology, and they can do the work through improved workflows, and therefore reducing the number of people. So it can be both of those. So either lower cost labour, I wouldn't agree with low skilled labour, because it's still the quality of the work that you're being measured on.
And so very often the actual people that tomorrow are with another company is the same person that was your finance or billing clerk earlier today.
It depends on the geography and depends where you outsource to, whether that happens. But yes, and just having the same people with better technologies and better workflows will take cost out of the process. Or you can go to highly skilled labour in low-cost economies. So there are many, many different options.
So we're getting onto the topic of we're seeing temporary employees, contractors, outsourcing relationships. Some say that contractors and outside employees is the future of human capital. I heard a recent U.S. report that detailed children being born today will have a dozen or so employers by the age of 28. Do you see that this is becoming a trend for the world?
I think people still want to work for companies, feel part of that company, and feel very loyal. And quite often people will see a long-term career with companies. I don't think that will change. I think what will change is, or what is changing, is the requirements that employees now have of the company they work for. So I think employees are going to become more demanding. We'll want to only work for companies with the classic value sets that match theirs. Or that give them the opportunity for development or whatever it is that they, you know, went to join that company to get. Some people join companies because it's absolutely right for them in their career or their work-life balance to work for that company because it offers them the flexibility. And when they don't need that flexibility anymore, they may choose to work for another company or stay with the company and do a different role where that flexibility isn't required. So I think for me, whereas the equity ratio of employer to employee was classically the employer's side, I think much more good organisations are making sure that that equity ratio is in balance.
So with all these very early on redundancies and layoffs that you've been involved in, do you see now the element of loyalty of an employee shifting? You know, in my father's day and his father's day, it was typically you started with a company when you were whatever age you left school, whether it was 14 or 16 or 18 or perhaps beyond. You stayed with one company until you retired and they gave you a great pension, and that's not the case. 2-3 years is perhaps a long job.
Yeah, I have to say I still think people will be doing that. Still, people will be aspiring to work for a company for a long time and have a great career with companies who look after them and give them great career development. And if that's not there, then they'll move. So I think that's the difference. Now, clearly, when the economy's tough and people haven't got the choices externally that they may have had in other eras, then clearly, you know, you may get frustrated employees who want to leave but can't find somewhere to go to. But, you know, good managers should understand that of their people, should work with their people, should help them move on if that's right for them to move on. So I think it works both ways. I think companies should be honest with their people if they don't see a future for them, and employees absolutely have the right to move if there isn't a future for them.
And obviously, there's, being the CFO in me, there's a cost to hiring. There's a cost to the process and the time, not only to the people on the inside, but there's an investment on the people that are prospectively looking at your company to be the employer. But there's a cost of firing, and there's a cost of that new engagement of activity to bring somebody on. Are there any studies that might indicate kind of a, I suppose I look at things as a break-even analysis, but maybe more from a perspective of human resources, it's a time and it's an investment perspective. Is that how you would see it?
sorry about that. I'm not so sure I look at it in that light, but I can understand the question. I mean, I think all the time employees feel like they're being valued by their employer. And I also think, you know, employees want to give value back. So I think that's where I would see the balance equation. I think...
And that's still true of today's Gen X, Gen Y, Millennium baby?
Yeah, I think so. And, gosh, sorry about that. I think people are probably going to be more open and honest about it and maybe understand it. It's probably always been there, but below the surface, because, as you say, in eras gone by, people expected to work for a company for that long, good or bad. I think you know, employees now are absolutely saying, I will work for this company as long as I'm getting what I want to get from that company, and the equity ratio is in balance. I think
so. The shift of control, basically.
Yes, definitely. And I think I would absolutely say attrition is good for a company. You know, to have zero attrition is not healthy. If you had zero attrition, how are you going to find opportunities for the youngsters coming through, or the people who want to change career later on in life? If you haven't got attrition, you've just got blocks. So I think attrition is good, and I think you need to understand that, you know, there is a healthy level of attrition, but it can become unhealthy if there's too much. And, you know, that's when you are into the costs of rehiring, the costs of reskilling. But I would say, well, why is your attrition that high? If that's the case, you need to find what's the root cause, deal with the root cause. And it may be because people don't find they're getting, you know, the equity ratio, the employer, the employee values being met.
Well, Louise, that is very, very insightful, certainly to a finance person that I am. This has been fabulous. Now, we have a tradition on our show as our last question to ask your CFO tip of the month. I'm not sure if that's necessarily an appropriate question for you, but from the seat of human resources, what is your CFO tip of the month?
Well, my tip of the month would be for everybody, just get close to your customers. You know, I'm in HR, I work with finance colleagues, and absolutely, we should be out there with our salespeople, you know, talking to our customers. You know, tell us about our people. Are they delivering? Have they got the right skill sets? Are we treating you the right way? Because you can understand your company's needs really well by talking to your customers and taking that feedback back. I don't do enough of it. You know, when I have the opportunity, when I'm working on outsourcing deals, to get close to customers and talk firsthand with them, and I love it. But, you know, I'm sure most senior execs would be saying they don't get enough time with customers. And I think that's true of finance people as it is as true of HR people and other functional people as well.
Well, that is a great tip. Thank you. And thank you to Louise Fisher, our guest today, for sharing your most innermost thoughts of the human resource function as it impacts the CFO. Thank you to our contributors, the reports from the Securities and Exchange Commission. And thank you also to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to www.delaneyllc.com. To SAP Business by Design, the software as a service business management solution for small and medium-sized companies. For more information on their product, go to www.sap.com. This and other thought leadership about today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO and would like to be a guest on the show, please go to the web and click on the link and let us know about you. Thank you today for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time.